is Emma Vaughan Jones in the studio for From the Frontline. Tonight I have in the studio with me Dr. Peter Hammond and Reverend John Clifford. Good evening.
Good evening, Emma.
Good evening.
So tonight we're going to be discussing the current unfoldings happening in Sudan. And Islamic Sudan, as we know, has experienced a series of revolutions and coups d'etats and wars since it was granted independence in January 1956. And this year hasn't been much difference, although on the 17th of August, the military government and civilian opposition alliance signed a power-sharing deal, which has sparked hopes of some level of peace and freedom coming to the country. So what has led to this extraordinary development?
Well, this has been extraordinary because Sudan hasn't known much peace. Since the British left on the 1st of January 1956, they've been in war from the first day. Effectively against the black Christian and animus south, and it hasn't really stopped, and there's been six, and with this latest in April this year, seven revolutions or coups d'etats, violent changes of government in Sudan. So I don't know that they've ever had a legitimate leadership, not since the British left, because it's been one corrupt bunch of criminals after the other, and military seizing and Islamist groups. So what actually led to this specific thing is that the dictator, who we would not want to say a good word about, but Omar al-Bashir, who's wanted for war crimes, wanted for genocide, but has been charged with corruption by the military council that's taken over. I would have thought that his International Criminal Court, ICC, charges for war crimes, mass rape, killing, pillage, which was then escalated the next year up to even genocide, three counts of separate genocide, which includes both South South Kordofan, Darfur, and Blue Nile. So they are looking at different areas where he's guilty of genocide. And yet, despite the International Criminal Court wanting him on charge of genocide with warrants for his arrest, the military council said that they removed him from office in response to the public protests to charge him for corruption. And there's no talk about handing him over to the ICCC, the criminal court, no trial at The Hague. So apparently, according to the news media, this has been primarily people protesting in the streets because of austerity measures, cutting fuel and bread subsidies, and the people having enough, and it's almost like another Arab Spring kind of idea of protests and the people in the streets, and there's a woman standing on top of the cars speaking to the crowds, and the image given is that there's a popular revolution and the military has responded to the popular masses. That's the news headlines of what they've said, and so that apparently the military took him into custody, which we don't know if that's true or not, but he seems to be out of power. Whether he's being protected or just replaced remains to be seen.
You know, you say that they haven't given him over to The Hague because of his war crimes. Well, I think the people who would hand him over would have to hand themselves over at the same time, which is why they're not doing anything.
True.
I mean, it's much like what we've seen in Zimbabwe and what we've seen in many other countries where he's not acting alone. Omar al-Bashir, yes, he may be the apex of bad guys in Africa, but he's not. He doesn't act alone. It's not like he went to Darfur or Southern Kordofan or Blue Nile with an AK-47 and shot everyone. He gave the orders. People carried it out. And so everybody under him would also have to face justice. And of course, nobody wants to face justice when you're guilty of things like what they're being accused of, genocide, mass rape, and all those kinds of things. And so this is really a country that has been at war for decades. And what has been very peculiar is that it's been the citizens of Sudan who have risen up against the government, and not just the rebel groups like Darfur and Southern Kordofan and Blue Nile. Yes, of course, they've been fighting with the government for a long time because they've been marginalized. They've been targeted for their ethnicity, their tribe, their land, and in the case of Southern Kordofan, for their Christian faith. But these are people from within the capital, Khartoum, who rose up against the government because of the way that they mistreat all their civilians. the country was just sliding economically to the point where people couldn't even afford bread anymore. And they just had had enough. And it seemed like it was the hair that broke the camel's back when it was just a financial crisis. And the people were protesting in the streets. They were going right outside of a major military barracks in Khartoum, which is pretty brave, considering what the government is capable of and their track record, and protesting that they want al-Bashir to be removed. And so that's what the military did. They took him down. But the people who have replaced him aren't exactly much better, and I'm sure we're going to get into that.
Exactly. Who did take over after al-Bashir was removed in April?
Well, there's a few interesting names. The one is General Muhammad Hamid Hemeti. Hemeti is a nickname. It basically means a little Muhammad, which he's got a baby face, they say. So even though he's the most powerful man in Sudan, his surname's Dagolo. In fact, all of his generals are Dagolo, and everyone is from... He's basically an Arab from the Darfur region. And so Hemeti Dagolo is his correct name, though, is Muhammad Hamid. And Hemeti is his nickname, Dagolo. He's the most powerful person, but he's like vice president of this military council. Then there's Lieutenant General Abdul Fattah Abdul Rahman Burham. I don't know why they've got to have such long names, but and he's effectively the new president of the military council. And so they are now the government. They've got a 7-member military council. They're the ones who took power. So basically, the head of the military and a very shadowy, weird figure, the head of the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, who is this Hemeti or Dagolo. They are the ones who formed the new government. And this is intriguing because this Hemeti, he started out as the notorious Janjaweed militia. The Janjaweed militia were, I mean, these are bandits at best, war criminals and genocidal maniacs at worst. But they've actually morphed into a phenomenal international crime syndicate, doing everything from controlling the gold in Sudan, in the Western Sudan, to human trafficking. And they, in fact, involved now with military contracts with tens of thousands of soldiers. They've now got 70,000 soldiers in this Rapid Support Forces, which is effectively a glorified militia. Mm. But they've got 10,000 land cruisers. That's a lot of money right there that they've... Where do they get all this from? Well, they're controlling the gold. They're also controlling some of the oil. They are involved in a huge amount of criminal enterprises. And they're providing soldiers by the tens of thousands for Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates for fighting in Yemen, which is, what has this got to do with anything? And these are the people who are basically... So when the people on the ground thought, wow, our protests in the streets removed this dictator, Omar al-Bashir, power to the people. But it seems that behind the scenes is a shadowy criminal figure who's been actually the key figure in the Darfur genocide, and who's been a prime mover, if I'm not mistaken, in South Kordofan, the Nuba Mountains massacres. Isn't he the one that the people in Nuba say has been doing most of the attacks on them too?
Well, his troops, I don't think he personally, he had another one by the name of Horan, who was, he's the leader in northern Kordofan, who moved into Kaduglia and did a whole lot of the atrocities back in 2011 and so on. But
he was one of his underlings.
It's one of the militia of Hemeti's group, yes.
Yes. So effectively, you've got two of the worst human rights abuse areas of Sudan, and Sudan's done a lot of human rights abuses in their years of so-called independence. In the 7 revolutions and military dictatorships and Islamicist regimes and Sharia laws. But Hemeti, this man who's been behind, who put his weight behind overthrowing the dictator of the last 30 years in Omar al-Bashir's case. And so the people on the ground who think, oh, you know, our protest against this massive military dictatorship managed to remove a dictator, they might be thinking that it's that simple. Our protests have brought about now a transition to democracy, which is what we'd all like to believe. I mean, that would really be nice. And everyone's desperate for hope in Sudan. And I think when you were in Nuba Mountains last, the people were really, really hoping that this is maybe going to mean peace.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, I was there when Omar al-Bashir was taken down, and they were rioting in Khartoum, and the people were hoping for the military council to hand over power to the people. They wanted it instantly. Those were the terms of the protests. And then the military said, well, let's give us some time, and we can't just hand it over to the people. There needs to be a process. We need to make sure this is done well and fairly. Dragged it on and on and on, months and months, until now, so that they could have some time to strategize. But if people were hopeful, I mean, people were celebrating, they were saying, this is what we've been hoping for, this is what we've been praying for. Finally, Omar al-Bashir has been taken down, but only to find out now that the person who has essentially taken his place, although he's not the sole leader, but is this guy Hemeti, who's the face of the military council. He's the one who is talking to the West. If you go into the BBC News website, you will see him talking about the deal that they just signed and saying, we want to take Sudan further. We want to take it into the future. We will stick to every word of the agreement that we've signed. And sort of seems like a very well-meaning, well-intentioned individual if you don't know anything about him. So, you know, the people have been very hopeful and probably right now are hopeful. I haven't seen video footage, but I've read that people were dancing in the streets. There was a great jubilation. The people were very excited and so forth when this deal was signed. But the deal itself is not all that much to really talk about, because the deal is that over the period of 36 months...
3 years.
3 years, there will be a military council, five people from leaders from the military, and five representatives from the civilian opposition coming together with an 11th person who the people of Sudan are meant to elect to go through a process of bringing about democracy in Sudan, and which will end when the people of Sudan vote for their president, the person that they want to actually rule. Mm-hmm. But during those 3 years, the first two-thirds of it, the military of Sudan is going to rule everything. And so judging by what these guys have done in the past, you know, I wouldn't want them to rule me for another 2 years on a contractual basis, you know, saying, okay, you can rule for the next 2 years. We'll stop our protests and everything like that. I mean, it doesn't look that promising.
You're losing momentum. They've got a tremendous amount of momentum. In fact, this looks awfully suspiciously like what just happened in Zimbabwe. A bit more than a year and a half ago, we had jubilation in Zimbabwe because it looked like Mugabe was gone, a new day has dawned, Zimbabwe is open for business. Mnangagwa, okay, sure, Enoch Mnangagwa is a mass murderer who was the hitman, the chosen successor of Mugabe by Mugabe, and yes, he had overseen the massacres of tens of thousands of Matabele and so on. But hey, that's all past now, and he's going to open Zimbabwe for business and open for investment. And he promised a lot, and there was a lot of excitement, and the people were dancing in the streets, even with signs like, you know, we've forgiven you to the Zimbabwe army because they'd just removed Mugabe. And there was tremendous celebrations. People, even Pond, dancing on the tables, and they just looked like such... And you understood. I mean, we understood because... We were desperate for hope. We really wanted to believe this meant something new for Zimbabwe. But, well, John, what's the latest from Zimbabwe?
Nothing good. I mean, inflation has escalated once again. Not that they have their own currency to begin with. They have this fake monopoly money that they're calling bond notes, which is, it's a nothing. It's a nonsense thing to trade with, which you can't use internationally. But that thing has now become essentially worthless. People are rioting in Zimbabwe. I just heard that they had to deploy some troops in Gweru to try and calm down the protesters. I mean, it's just another version of Mugabe. It's Mugabe with a different face. It's still ZANU-PF, because people haven't realized that there is actually a worldview problem going on over here. It's not just simply, well, this guy is bad, so let's replace him with another guy that might be better. It's, no, this individual has a particular worldview called communism that at its core is antichrist and at its core hates image bearers of God, human beings, and has a desire to really boost the man on the top, even though it pretends to be for the people and, you know, all the great promises the communists make. All that's happened is one communist has replaced another communist. So what do you expect? Well, you expect the communist to act like a communist.
Yes, so in fact, we have been warning the people in Zimbabwe for 38 years that the problem is not just the one individual. Yes, Robert Mugabe is bad and evil, just like Omar al-Bashir was certainly as evil as they come. There's no question about it, and we're not justifying him. But it's the party. After Lenin, there was Stalin. After Stalin, there was Brezhnev. After Brezhnev, there was Khrushchev, and then there's Brezhnev, and then there's Chernenko and Yandropov, and then there's Gorbachev. And under all of them, Christians were being persecuted, and the KGB secret police were locking people up, and there were millions of Christians in the concentration camps. Even under Gorbachev's perestroika, there was 5 million people in concentration camps, including 1 million people for religious offence alone. And that was detente and perestroika and glasnost. So to tell the people, you've got to get rid of the Communist Party. And same with Sudan. The problem here, we've got to get people to stop having the idea that all you need is Mary Poppins to come and say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, click the fingers, everything gets organised, and decades of disobedience and bad decisions gets wiped out. No, God is not mocked. What a man sows, he will reap. There's consequences. And so in Sudan, as in Zimbabwe, as in South Africa, as in every country in the world, we need to recognise that if we want God to heal our land, he needs to hear our prayers and forgive our sins. And to do that, he says there's four things we've got to do. We've got to humble ourselves, we've got to pray, we've got to seek God's face, we've got to turn from our wicked ways. Then he will hear from heaven, forgive our sin, and heal our land. And people who want to be cowards, be disobedient to God, break his commandments, support or be silent and cowardly about wickedness and evil, and for that matter, send their children off to be indoctrinated by the state indoctrination gulag, whether it's Sharia law, Islamic indoctrination in Khartoum, or it's Marxist, secular humanist indoctrination in Harare, it comes the same thing, that we've got to have people recognize there's got to be a wholehearted turn to God and a rebuilding of every area of life, starting with my own life and our families and church and community on biblical basis. There's no alternative for wholehearted repentance and a complete reorientation according to a biblical worldview. So sadly, the people in Sudan, and I also think of another Zimbabwe analogy, because back in 2008, the people in Zimbabwe voted to get rid of Mugabe and ZANU-PF, which was a complete victory at the polls. And somehow or another, Mugabe convinced them to have a second election, where then their army and police bludgeoned and beat the people to such an extent that that the party that won the elections was willing to accept a subordinate position in the government of national unity, where, you know, it's like you just won the Olympics, but you get to stand on the second tier and the one who lost stands on number one. He gets a gold medal, you get the silver. And so the man who won the election in Zimbabwe in 2008 became the prime minister, which had no defined role except to raise money and investment from overseas to help the bankrupt Zimbabwe government survive a bit longer. And Zimbabwe went through another 10 years of trauma after that, because even when the opposition, Morgan Tsvangirai, Movement for Democratic Change, had won the election, they were willing to be talked into a power-sharing arrangement, which they got rid of them as soon as they brought in more investment. And it looks to me like these demonstrators on the streets in Sudan are being talked into abandoning their momentum they'd built up. And, gee, the military can consolidate the power next 2 years, 3 years, very adequately to ensure whatever they want for the future.
And there's no doubt that they will. I mean, when we've spoken about the atrocities of this Hemeti for some time, but it wasn't that long ago, that just over a month ago, that the protesters were in Sudan, and it was his people who came into Khartoum. The military, the official military of the government, pulled out these rapid support forces came in, and you can actually watch all of the footage taking place. The supporters are there with their cell phones. All of a sudden, the military is leaving, and then these other guys in these land cruisers wearing a different uniform are coming in, and they're with the police. So it's not like just these random rogues came in. These are people who are definitely in collaboration with the military power, the ruling officials of the land. They roll in and they start opening fire on the people and they start running. People are screaming. They're shooting people seemingly indiscriminately, and not military on military. These are civilians. Mm. These are unarmed men and women and children that they're killing. Mm. And you see the people with their cell phones. You see the footage afterwards. Medical doctors have been shot. People on the side of the road have been shot. There are people from high buildings viewing down onto the streets, and you can see military and police beating people while they're on the ground, unconscious, just continually beating them. They were pulling people up out of the Nile who had these large concrete blocks wrapped around their feet that were just dumped in the Nile. So, you know, these are people who did very atrocious things just the other day.
Yes, one needs to emphasize, you're not talking about before the overthrow of Omar al-Bashir. This is afterwards.
Yes.
This is 3 June.
Yes, this is what the current man who is the face
of the transition council
has just done to the people he is now meant to take into the future and take forward and so on.
Since removing al-Bashir, who's been blamed for everything. So if one looks at the timescale and one looks at the players, it doesn't look hopeful in the short term.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Bashir is obviously not solely to blame, and all the people that were working closely around him obviously have similar ideas and ideals. And so I'm sure his regime is so deeply entrenched, and it's going to take time to dismantle this. As far as I understand, Hameti, being this vice president of the Sudan's Transitional Military Council, is being backed at the moment by Egypt, Saudi Arabia, UAE, and also there's stories all over the news about al-Bashir's trial receiving $90 million from Saudi Arabia. So what do you make of these connections and alliances?
This is very significant, because what's made it possible for this Hameti is gold was discovered in Jabal Amir in North Darfur in just 2012. That's not long ago.
Sure.
And just as Sudan was facing economic crisis, this gold seemed like a blessing, but it quickly turned into a curse.
Mm.
Tens of thousands of Arabs flocked to this remote corner of Darfur in a gold rush, where many were crushed in collapsing mine shafts. Many were poisoned by the mercury and arsenic used to process the gold nuggets. Some gold was sold to the government, which paid way above market prices because it was so desperate to get its hands on the gold, which it then could sell in Dubai. That's the destination of most of the gold, for hard currency. But other gold was smuggled across the border to Chad, where it was exchanged in rackets involving buying stolen vehicles stolen from some NGOs or missions and smuggled back into Sudan. And what they managed, basically a 1.5 kilogram bar of gold would get you a new Land Cruiser. And these were stolen from aid agencies or missions, driven back into Darfur, fitted out with, of course, the mandatory machine guns, 12.7s and so on. And then with this, the rapid support forces, Hameti's private army, this militia, are policing the border, extracting bribes, levies, ransoms, engaging in human trafficking all across the Chad border and all across the Libyan border. They're even fighting in Libya. At the same time, he's selling his soldiers, and he's got 70,000 men and more than 10,000 armed pickup trucks and land cruisers. And he's effectively... he's the de facto ruler of Sudan. He's got more money, he's got more men, he's got more power, he's got more disposable income than the government or the military. So what he's now independent of the government. He's got his own source of income. He doesn't need tax money or anything because he's running a gold and mercenary international criminal enterprise, which is now in alliance with Saudi Arabia and with the United Arab Emirates in the war in Yemen. So what you've seen is Sudan, which not that long ago was allied with Iran, has shifted to Iran's enemies, which is Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. And that's intriguing. But what's also fascinating is that Hameti is involved in a new scheme, which is in the billions, for building a new actual port just south of Port Sudan. And this is being funded by Turkey. And Turkey and Qatar are in... alliance, and this is amazing that Turkey will have a port on the Red Sea, which is phenomenal. So this is like the mercenary freebooters that you had over the 19th century publicly swore allegiance to the Khedive of Egypt, but set up and ruled their own private empires. So this Hemeti is now a military political entrepreneur whose paramilitary criminal enterprise empires transcending national and legal boundaries. Well, I think he's broken every legal boundary. And yet he's the most powerful individual in Sudan today. And it's this person who has actually facilitated the removal of his previous sponsor, al-Bashir,
mm-hmm.
while protecting from International Court of Justice, and who has guaranteed this transition to military, from military to civilian rule in 3 years, if he's to be trusted. And it's he who the people on the ground are actually trusting that their political protests are going to bring about some freedom and some independence for them. So this is very shadowy, because Omar al-Bashir was so bad, I would have thought it couldn't get any worse.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what do you think, John? I mean, could it get worse?
It could get worse. I think it could get worse. Look, who knows what the future holds? We're not prophets here. But this guy doesn't have a very good track record. He's got a very bad track record. And he seems to have always moved his way up through all kinds of shady things. I mean, he started off as a camel trader, and then all of a sudden he was helping people transport goods, and he was effectively like a hired mercenary between Darfur and Chad for a time, and then coddled up to the government during the Darfur war, and all of a sudden now he's basically ruling the country, you know. So this is a very
way past the Sudan borders.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's got the support of Egypt, he's got the support of the UAE, he's got the support of Saudi Arabia and all of these things. And let's also not forget that there are other countries that are very concerned with Sudan, that now I've heard a lot of stories about these things, but I've heard that many other countries like Saudi Arabia and so on wanted Sudan to effectively be like the caliphate of Africa, to be the place from which Islam reigns in Africa. Now, I don't know exactly if that's true, but I have a good reason to think that it is true. And so there are a lot of other countries that want to see Sudan continue in Sharia law. What the citizens of Sudan are wanting is a secular state. That's what they're saying they want. I just don't see any way of that happening, because it is by having Sharia law that Sudan can have these partners with the UAE, with Saudi Arabia, and so on and so forth. It is this religious connection that they have to these guys that in part empowers them. Now, of course, there are other things as well, like gold and money, which may be even a stronger tie than their religion. I don't know. But I don't see anything good coming from this character.
Mm.
Absolutely not. I mean, how could you? You'd have to be an absolute fool to think that anything good would come from him.
Mm.
And this is what I was saying when Zimbabwe was going through the riots, and I'll say it over here now. The people need to desire justice, true justice.
Mm.
Of course, we can't totally expect that from people who do not have a Christian worldview. Let's not forget, Sudan is an Islamic country.
Mm.
But I don't see true justice taking place. Therefore, corruption will continue to breed. It always does. When people are not, this is a biblical principle, when criminals are not punished quickly, it just grows. It flourishes. That's from the book of Ecclesiastes.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if he's not going to get punished, I don't think that the situation will get much better.
Mm.
That's true. And bear in mind, 2011, a lot of people have been drawing connections with the Arab Spring. Well, I remember the Arab Spring in 2011, and honestly, it was catastrophic. Everything that was promised turned out to be a complete and utter lie. The Arab Spring didn't make life better for anybody. It brought down Libya, it brought down Tunisia, it brought down Syria into a terrible civil war in which hundreds of thousands have lost their lives and millions have lost their homes. And Egypt, of course, tremendous chaos in Egypt with overthrowing Mubarak's regime and bringing in the Muslim Brotherhood, who destroyed Christian place of worship that had stood for centuries and over a millennium in some cases. In one weekend, the Muslim Brotherhood destroyed 74 churches just in Egypt. And Mubarak, for all his sins, he did have soldiers protecting Christian churches schools and monasteries 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And now we know why, because he is protecting from the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. And so when the American government, which remember then was being run by Barack Hussein Obama and by Hillary Clinton as the Secretary of State, and they were the biggest sponsors of this Arab Spring. The Arab Spring destroyed Christianity in the Middle East to the extent that before the Arab Spring, there were 15 million Christians in the Middle East. Now there's about 10 million left.
Sure.
The Middle East has lost a third of their Christians since Arab Spring. Arab Spring has been a catastrophe for Christians in Iraq, Christians in Syria, Christians in Egypt. They have suffered a lot. And so let's bear in mind that the last Arab Spring was nothing to do with democracy. It was everything to do with a radical Islamist, anti-Christian, anti-Western revolution. And so if they're talking about this being something like the Arab Spring, then you really must beware, because nothing good comes out of it, because the foundations aren't there. They haven't got the Christian foundations. In fact, they're chasing out the Christians, who are the real hope for the future in the country.
Yeah. So what do you think then can be expected moving forward? Is there hope? Can we see democracy on the horizon? What do you guys see the future holding?
Well, just on the positive side is we know where the hope comes from. And that's why John was part of a team that delivered 40,000 Bibles.
This year, yeah.
And something like 70, 80,000 Bibles, books and textbooks. So you took in about 120,000 Bibles and books to distribute to 130 schools and a whole bunch of churches earlier this year in New Mountains. And last year you did almost as much. So putting Bibles in the hands of teachers, students, helping and empowering churches and schools, we think that is a way forward to give the people hope and textbooks and investing in education. Because the philosophy of education in the classroom in this generation could be the philosophy of government in the next generation.
That's right. And, you know, we're talking about Sudan. Sudan is effectively four countries at the moment. You have Sudan, which is run by Khartoum, which is what we're talking about now. But then there's Darfur. It's not under the Sudanese government. They're at war with them totally. They're governing themselves there. Same with Southern Kordofan and same with the Blue Nile. Now, you have these different areas of Sudan that there are fantastic works of the gospel happening in all of those as well as in Khartoum. Mm. And so the gospel is definitely spreading. Now, as far as our experience goes, we've seen the most fruit happening in Southern Kordofan, especially an area called the Nuba Mountains. We've seen the church growing. We've seen Muslims coming to Christ, surrendering to Christ on a massive scale. We were able to do open-air preaching. I mean, what other country do you go to? Islamic country. Actually, what other country do you go to at all where you are just able to do open-air preaching?
And get in all the schools.
And get into schools, right? Very few in terms of the world's countries. And which officially Islamic country do you get to do that? And deliver tens of thousands of Bibles, Christian books, go into schools, go into Muslim schools, preach the gospel, and be openly accepted there.
I believe even not only with the school principal's happy to receive you, but even the governor of the state was happy to have you do this work.
And he is a Muslim. That's correct.
Sure.
So, wow.
Yeah.
That gives hope for the future.
Exactly. And I think that what's happened is because Khartoum represents Sharia law and Islamic government, even the Muslims of these other areas have recognized there's something about our religion that isn't right. Now, they're not ready to abandon it yet en masse. There are many who have, but they haven't totally abandoned it. But they recognize the Christians are our friends. And I've heard incredible stories from refugees from Darfur, for example, who go to other countries and they will not accept relief aid from Muslims, even though they were Muslims at the time. Muslims from Darfur. They would teach their children only accept the relief aid that has a cross on it, because we know that's the one we can trust.
Sure.
And so they're taught to trust the cross from it, even though it's not necessarily become a Christian.
Yeah.
But there you can see these people who they're recognizing there's a destruction to Islam. There's something wicked about it.
Especially the jihad Sharia law version.
Right.
Which is very
which is what they've been exposed to, which has subsequently led to a very open door to Christian influence, and that open door needs to be filled with the gospel, not simply Christian relief aid. Wonderful that we're showing them love. Necessary. Great. But it must be gospel-centered. And it is happening. Absolutely. And people are coming to Christ.
Yeah.
And of course, we're planning more.
Yes.
So the people, the Sudanese people, are hoping for and trying to work for democracy. How does that fit in with Sharia law, democracy and Sharia law? Are they hoping to vote that out? Or
it doesn't fit in. In fact, I've seen Muslims speaking very openly about the fact that they don't want Sharia law. So there's many Muslims out there who are saying, you know, we're Muslims, but we want freedom, we want secular state, we don't want Sharia law. So I don't think this is an anti-Muslim thing when many Muslims are saying, we don't want Sharia law.
Mm.
So yes, this is the amazing thing when we find ourselves not just invited to Christian schools, but invited to Muslim schools with a Muslim principal, with Muslim majority students, and then they allow you to come in, present the gospel and hand out Bibles, as you've had the opportunity to do this year.
Yes, that's correct.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and you know, if we don't know what the future holds, my thinking is it's going to be very confusing and chaotic, because that's just how these kinds of guys operate. They create chaos so that they can provide the solution so that they can come out on top.
Solution.
Right. So that's the way it works with communism and with just corruption and with Islam as well. It's the way things work. Whatever it is, it's going to be confusing and difficult to wrap your mind around. And somehow, some way, there's going to be some military power that comes out on top. That's the likely scenario in my thinking. But we don't know. There could be something else wonderful that happens. There could be a massive revival in Sudan. Mm-hmm. Maybe the people from Southern Kordofan will spread throughout the rest of the country and be missionaries, which is what we're hoping and praying for, which is what they want too.
They were talking about that they're looking forward to a moment of peace, that they can be missionaries to the rest of the country, when you were there.
Yes, that's the reason why they were praying for peace in Sudan. That's why they were celebrating when there were riots in Khartoum. Now we can be missionaries without persecution to the rest of our brothers around Sudan.
Wow, how inspiring. Mm. Is it possible that this war against Christians in the Nuba Mountains and South Kordofan could come to an end?
We certainly hope so. Considering that the man who is heavily involved in his organization is heavily involved in the persecution of Christians in South Kordofan, that doesn't seem to give hope, but they're distracted. And when you've got so much crisis in the capital, it maybe gives more freedom for some of these outer provinces who've been trying to secede to operate independently. So I think what could come out of this is maybe they will get so obsessed with what's going on there and the gold in Darfur, northern Darfur, that maybe South Kordofan, Blue Nile will be left alone for a while. So we could expect, at least in the short term, a breather.
Yeah.
And in fact, right now there is a ceasefire effectively generally in place in South Kordofan, which we're grateful for, and that's in fact provided an opportunity for a lot of ministry that wouldn't have been easily possible otherwise. So certainly, in the Chinese language, the word crisis is made up of two characters, danger and opportunity. Every crisis has a danger and it's got an opportunity. And as Christians, we've got to recognize that bad times are good for spiritual work. And so every crisis is an opportunity for us to advance the gospel and to teach people discipleship principles and biblical worldview. And so this opportunity, while the world's media may be having unrealistic hopes, like they tried to sell us with the Arab Spring back in 2000, oh, this is just going to be so wonderful, which it wasn't. I think right now they're trying to sell this, but nevertheless, what we are seeing is an opportunity for missions to advance in equipping the people with the Bibles and books and textbooks they need, and being able to help them to build better communities and better schools, which hopefully in a generation can reflect in the society. But right now, let's face it, we're seeing the consequences of generations of bad decisions and bad education going on in the government schools. So now that you've got independent schools and Christian schools and Christian textbooks out there, we as missionaries, we're working for the long-term view, generationally. Mm-hmm.
Just to give you an idea of the kind of resistance that's going on in these areas we're talking about, in Southern Kordofan, they've taken it so far that they don't even want their children being educated in Arabic. Mm-hmm. That's how much they are resisting the Islamization of the North, and the Arabization of the North, maybe I should say. They're even wanting to teach their children in English, which means that which means that there is now opportunity to give them English books, English textbooks, and so on. And we have no shortage of Christian material in English. Mm-hmm. In fact, I mean, I may be mistaken by this, but I am assuming that most of the Christian literature in the world is in English today. I mean, we have...
Statistically, that's true.
Yeah, so what a wonderful opportunity.
Both quantity and variety.
Yeah.
So just for listeners to understand, if they haven't grasped this from previous film, The Frontlines, we are being invited by Arabic-speaking people in an Arabic part of Sudan, such as South Kordofan, where the majority language has always been Arabic, where the official language has been Arabic. Please bring us English textbooks. Yes, Bibles, please, other textbooks. We've taken Biblical Principles for Africa. We've taken Faith and Divine Sudan. We've taken Slavery, Terrorism, and Islam books, and providing these to schools, and Bibles, full Bibles. The whole Bible, every one, 66 books. And Muslim schools even are taking it, not necessarily because they want the Bible as much as they want English, because they are resisting the Arabization, Islamization policies of the government. So this crisis has provided us with an unprecedented opportunity to go into the 1040 window in the Muslim Middle East, in Sudan, which is officially a Sharia law country, and provide tens of thousands of Bibles and tens of thousands of Christian textbooks to Muslim-majority schools in Muslim areas because they want to learn English. So, yeah. So praise God, even bad times can be good for spiritual work.
Absolutely. So what can people do to help the Christians that have been suffering in Sudan for all these decades?
Be informed, be interceding, be involved. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. We've got to get our people informed to get them involved. Now, you'll find a lot of videos and audios and articles on the frontlinemissionsa.org website, frontlinemissionsa.org. Look for the Sudan articles. Now, remember, there's Sudan, which includes the Nub Mountains, and there's South Sudan, which is now the independent part where we've done a lot of work in the past. And so look at those articles. You get updates, and there's been presentations. There's the book, Faith and Defined Sudan. The third edition is three times the size of the original one. And that gives the story of Sudan through history all the way up to its independence, 2011. So it goes right up to 2010, what led to independence. Then we've also got the different videos on Sudan. Sudan in Holocaust, Terrorism, Persecution, 3 Days in Sudan, filmed by professionals. We took the teams in. And those are all available from christianlibertybooks.co.za or off the frontlinemissionsa.org website. So get informed, get interceding, and get involved. Now, you could go onto our page and download the prayer posters. Pray for Sudan, pray for the Nub Mountains. These are prayer posters you can either upload on your websites or print it out, put it on your church notice board. Get people praying. Organize for some midweek service or prayer meeting to see some of the Sudan videos, look at the different clips, report backs, or print out some of our reports and inform the people and get your people praying. And then also mobilizing your people to maybe be writing letters to the Sudan embassy in your country, speaking up, writing letters to your local a senator or your local newspapers to get people informed and interceding and putting pressure on the powers that be in government so that the Christians of Sudan know they're not alone, they're not forgotten, and that the people causing grief to them recognize people around the world are watching.
I wonder what many of the international Christians are doing for the people of the Nuba Mountains. The people of the Nuba Mountains are weeping for the prayers of their brothers and sisters in Christ around the world. I looked into the eyes, the tearful eyes of a chaplain, and he was saying the international community just doesn't care for us. Sure. Now, we were able to encourage them. We were able to give them the book, Faith Under Fire in Sudan, and show them, actually, there are many who care for you. And that encouraged them greatly. But know that there are people, individuals, there are mothers with children, there are men who are providers of households, there are young teenage girls, there are young 7-8-year-old boys who barely have an education. There are people whose crops have been bombed, people who are fearful for their lives, families that have been separated. They need your prayers, so pray for them. Go onto the Frontline website and just get everything that you can on Sudan and pray intentionally, pray the scriptures, pray for their safety, pray for their purity, pray for their holiness, pray for their courage, pray with all prayer and supplication for them at all times. I think prayer is one of the most vital things that people can do. And then look for ways to support missions to Sudan. These things don't just happen. These things need the support of individuals, of churches, businessmen and women. See how you can be supporting missionaries to these areas. Now is a vital time. Now is a strategic time. There is upheaval and turmoil, which is a fantastic opportunity for missionaries to be going in the back door and ministering to people who are hurting, who are asking questions. And ministering where the enemy is not looking right now. And so this is a great opportunity before us, but prayer and support are absolutely essential.
Absolutely. And Sudan's spoken about in the Bible. It says that Cush will submit herself to God, and from beyond the rivers of Cush, my worshippers, my scattered people will bring me offerings, it says in Zephaniah 3:10. And so even with all this chaos going on, we can remember that we serve a God of order, and that if we humble ourselves, we turn to Him, we seek His face, we pray for the people pray. These people will have to face justice one day and judgment, and whether that happens in this life or in the next, we know that they will receive justice. And so we can look towards this eternal hope, even in amongst the chaos and turmoil that we are facing today. So thank you very much. Good evening.